series of lectures last week on relating to my first book, which is on world religions, called Physicians of the Soul. And we talked about Lao Tzu, Moses, a little bit on Jesus, not too much, Gautama Buddha, Krishna in Hinduism, and Mohammed. Mohammed in Islam was the most popular, so I'll remember that. Looking at all of those people, Richard Maurice Buck, who lived in the, born about 1837 and died about 1901, so he's mostly a 19th century man, felt they had something in common, and I used to wonder as a child. I grew up in the Reformed Jewish tradition, reading the Bible and all, how come all those experiences of God and God, communion with God and all, and God appearing in various forms and only occurred way back then in so-called biblical times and not now? Did you ever wonder about that? Do they occur now? People don't talk about them very much.
They talk about out-of-the-body experiences now that they wouldn't think of talking about before.
Well,
where they go through the tunnel and come out on the other side.
Oh yeah, in the past maybe 10 or 15 years, people are beginning to talk about these things again, and there are books like near-death experiences and so forth, and some books on mystical experiences, and there was a very interesting book written in the 1960s by Jean Houston and her husband Bob Masters on psychedelic experiences during that era, and I discovered something kind of interesting back then. But for a long time, religious experience, I think, was kind of taboo, was it? Both from the side of science, like psychiatry, which would say you were crazy if you had a mystical or religious experience, and from the side of religion, which in organized religions anyway, organized Christianity, doesn't too much encourage that kind of thing, but rather belief and creed and so forth. Maybe all of you have had a mystical or religious or spiritual experience. I don't know what the difference between those three things are. Probably philosophers would find differences between those three things. But I once asked one of my venerable teachers, Robert Johnson. He was the author, He, She, and We. I knew him before that, and he was a Benedictine monk. I said, what's the difference between a spiritual, religious, or mystical experiences? He said, I don't know. So that would answer that. Let me just tell you somewhat how these two books came about, my own personal experience. This book, Physicians of the Soul, was not written because I studied religion and up to PhD or anything like that. I actually never took a course in religion. It was all my own journey in which I studied and practiced in different spiritual and religious traditions, and the book idea popped into my mind, and then I wrote the book over a period of years, and it covers six, and the one it doesn't is a Native American, which I hadn't learned too much about at that time, but I want to look into that now. And the other book, this Cosmic Consciousness Revisited, this is kind of a strange name, but Richard Maurice Buck, who was a, I give you the dates of his life, about 1837 to 1901, was a Canadian, he's born in England, but he, his family moved to Ontario, Canada 1 year later, so he's mostly grew up in Canada, very rural on a farm at the time. Anyway, he had a profound mystical experience somewhere in his middle of his life, and from that, about over a period of 18 years, he wrote a book called Cosmic Consciousness, and it looks at what he feels is the common core of all of the great religions. He calls that cosmic consciousness, the experience of cosmic consciousness, and I had such an experience at age 20, which I attempt to write about a little in the preface. It's impossible really to describe that kind of thing, so just an attempt. In any event, so that's why I call the book Cosmic Consciousness Revisited. It looks at Richard Buck's life and work, and then he died in 1902, 1 year after his book was published. Had only sold 500 copies, but it's still in print in three editions, three paperback editions now. And I wondered, and he has very profound things to say about levels of consciousness up to what he calls cosmic consciousness, which is his name for the core, what he calls the core religious experience. He feels that what the different religions are talking about are, in their own language, that, whether it's nirvana, the Buddha talked about nirvana, he experienced under the meditation under the Bodhi tree for 40 days. What he experienced was nirvana. Lao Tzu, the Chinese sage, talked about the Tao, and Jesus talked about the kingdom of God, and various other names. The Hindus talk about Brahman, and in any event, for Buck, that was, he feels that most of us live, human beings, and most psychologists would agree, live at that a second level of self-consciousness. He has four levels of mind, perceptual, receptual, conceptual, and intuitional, and three levels of consciousness. Just what the difference between mind and consciousness is, I'm thinking about, but mind could be unconscious too, but consciousness is experienced. He would say, it's just kind of giving you his eventual theory, and I'll give you a little bit about his life that led up to that afterwards. He would feel that animals live at the level of simple consciousness. In fact, he divides that into two stages. Lower animals, say not invertebrates, like earthworms, sponges, starfish, hydra, the lower on the phylogenetic scale, not yet the vertebrates, or he feels live at a level of perceptual consciousness. Perceptual means that it's barely consciousness at all. They don't have a sense of the objects out there in space, but simply color, sound, whatever, smell, and they respond to that. You know about the behaviorists, I won't say too much about them, but they would say everything is stimulus response, and that would pretty much apply to that level, actually. They respond to stimuli. So I'll give you, that's a little bit ahead. And jump back a minute about my book. He and William James and he were contemporaries. I don't think they ever met, but they had some written correspondence. And William James wrote a book that was published almost the exact same time as Bach's book. In fact, his book was published in 1902. So they were both 19th century men. And he wrote the book, a letter very complimentary to Bach for his work, and said that your work, well, I haven't actually the exact words of his letters, but your work, after your work, no one can ignore the facts of religious or mystical experience anymore. You've really brought this out. But then, when the 20th century came, for at least the first half or more, almost maybe three quarters of the 20th century, the disciplines of psychology and psychiatry did totally ignore religious experience. Either there was no such thing, or this was a form of delusion or psychosis or whatever. I'm going to look at Sigmund Freud tomorrow morning, and he looked a lot of religious experience, but he wished to explain it away in terms of his psychoanalytic theory. Okay, so I wondered in writing that book after William James, who has a beautiful book called Varieties of Religious Experience. Varieties of Religious Experience. So, and Bach's book is Cosmic Consciousness. I wondered what happened in the next 100 years in psychology and psychiatry on those subjects, and that's what I wrote the book about, and I found that kind of went from a very high point right downhill to almost nothing with the behaviorists in the early 20th century, both in the United States and America and in this Russia and the Soviet Union, under both capitalism and Marxism. And both those systems, behaviorism developed, which not only didn't believe in religious experience or cosmic consciousness or mystical experience, but they said there was no consciousness at all. It was just stimulus response. So that was about, and most psychiatrists, even up to the 1970s, believe it or not, looked at religious experience. In the 1970s, there was a statement or a article in the one of the psychiatry journals, it's in my a book, stating that a religious or mystical experience they consider halfway between normality and psychosis. That was the statement. So that's changing now in the, to some extent, in the 80s and 90s. Okay. So back to Richard Maurice Bach. He grew up on Creek Farm, and his father was a pastor. I don't know what what denomination, but he brought with him from England several thousand books in various languages, and was the teacher of his children, his boys. His wife taught the daughters that had no schools then, and so he was quite educated by reading all those books and by his father. And at the age of 16, he left home and he went on a great adventure. This is Richard Buck. Well, just you mostly from books and things, you know what Freud looks like. You've seen Carl Jung probably, and even William James possibly. But no one knows too much. You don't probably haven't seen what Richard Buck looks like. So I found a old picture. I don't know if I have enough copies. I didn't know some people were going to attend. But this is what he looked like in his older days. I suppose after they invented the camera. You can pass that around.
Looks like John Muir.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, see John Muir.
Oh. Okay. So you get an idea of what he looked like in his older age. Anyway, at 16, as I said, he went on a left home and went on tremendous adventure in which he explored really the whole of North America for the next 5 years, and he worked as a gardener, a railroad worker, a farmhand, a fireman, a deckhand on a Mississippi steamboat, and a gold miner, and then he was determined to cross the Great Plains, and he crossed on a wagon train and passed through the lands of the Sioux and Pawnee Indians, and passed through immense herds of bison. But back then there were about 50 million or more, and by 1900 there were only a little over 200. That's another story. Got to Colorado, and he worked as a gold miner. And then he tried with a friend to cross the Sierra Nevadas to California in the fall, which was not a good time to do that. And there were tremendous snowstorms, and his friend died, and he got frostbite, and somehow he made it back, and with frostbite in both feet, and one of his feet had to be partially amputated. There's a movie that came out recently, last spring, called Beautiful Dreamers, which is actually about Richard Maurice Buck and his friendship with Walt Whitman. Did anybody see that? It's available in videos. Okay, so he came back, and his friends in the gold mine gave him enough money to get to Stagecoach to San Francisco, and then somehow he, maybe by ship the long way around, got all the way back to home, to Canada. By that time, both of his parents had died, and he had received an inheritance from his mother, and with that he went to medical school at the age of 21 to 25, and he graduated at the very number one in his class in medical school, and he went off to Europe, England, and France, I think, to study further. and then came back to set up a practice, and he was quite successful in medicine, and they say the Premier of Canada at the time was his first patient, and then he went from that to what was called the sort of precursor of psychiatry at the time, which was called medico-psychology. And he became, by I think age 40, by 40 he became superintendent of a asylum for the insane in Hamilton, Ontario, and then later another asylum in London, Ontario. At that time, there wasn't much treatment for mentally ill. They were put in straitjackets and padded cells and so forth. And he was an early reformer and a reformer in psychiatry. And he eliminated the use of straitjackets and padded cells and any restraints of any kind in his asylum. And he treated the his patients as human beings that they were, rather than crazy people. Much of the history of 20th century psychiatry isn't all that humane. Psychiatrist Thomas Szasz has a lot of books on what he calls psychiatric inhumanity, like involuntary hospitalization. There was a period when about 40 to 50,000 prefrontal lobotomies were done in the mid-20th century. drugs are pretty much the standard treatment today. Some say that that's kind of an internal straitjacket. In any event, he was interested in the stories of his patients, what they had to say, and in this he was kind of a precursor of Freud and Carl Jung, who were interested in what the patients had to say. So, that was his what he did in psychiatry. In his day, he was very prominent in psychiatry or medical psychology and was president of both the Canadian and the American Medical Psychological Associations, even though he kind of is was pretty much it's pretty much unknown today in psychiatry and clinical psychology, because he went in the direction that he did. It was outside of the scope of the worldview of psychiatry. It was in the 1860s, I'm sorry, he discovered the works of the poet Walt Whitman, the American poet Walt Whitman, and he said this in a letter to a friend, "Here is a man who receives images of spiritual and material things and transmits them without the least thought of what the world will say. He speaks from his own soul with the most perfect candor, sincerity, and truth. There is nothing in modern literature like it." he was later to go down to Camden, New Jersey, the home of Walt Whitman, without invitation, and meet him, and they became great friends. And he invited Walt Whitman, the poet, up to visit him and his asylum up in London, Ontario. And this is what Walt Whitman said about Buck. He said, "His method is peaceful, uncoercive, quiet, though always firm, rather persuasive than anything else. Buck is without brag or bluster. It is beautiful to see him at work, to see how he can handle difficult people with such an easy manner. That was the later, Buck was to be one of the early biographers of Walt Whitman. He wrote Walt Whitman, a Contemporary Study, in the 1880s that was published. But he had kind of the one of the key experiences of his life in 1872. He went to England for vacation and rest, and he describes this in his book, on a visit to England in the spring of 1872, he had the seminal experience of his life. It was a pleasant evening in the early spring. Buck and his friends had been discussing poetry, Shelley, Keats, Browning, and Whitman, and reading from it till midnight. Buck took his leave and rode home alone on his horse, drawn handsome. As he describes his experience in the third person, he talks about himself in the third person, all at once, without warning of any kind, he found himself wrapped around, as it were, with a flame-colored cloud. For an instant, he thought of fire, some conflagration. The next moment, he knew that the light was from within himself. Directly afterwards came upon him a sense of exaltation, of immense joyousness, accompanied or immediately followed by an intellectual illumination quite impossible to describe. Into his brain streamed one momentary lightning flash of Brahmic splendor. Brahmic is from Hindu, which has ever lightened his life. Upon his heart fell one drop of Brahmic bliss, leaving thenceforward for always and after a taste of heaven. Buck goes on to say, among other things that he did come to believe, he saw, and he wasn't a particularly religious man before this, he saw and knew that the cosmos is not dead matter, but a living presence, that the soul of man is immortal, that the universe is also built and ordered, that without any peradventure, all things work together for the good of each and all. St. Paul makes that statement, that the foundation principle of the world is what we call love, and that happiness of everyone is in the long run absolutely certain. He claims that he learned more within the few seconds during which this illumination lasted than in previous months or even years of study could ever have taught. So, people don't talk much about experiences like that. I found out that one of the other teachers last week had such an experience. I suppose we were talking about my book, and he had such an experience at age 19. And kind of started him on a spiritual quest. Experiences like that do tend to do something to your life, and
are you?
And he didn't do, as you see, he didn't do anything to. Like he wasn't a yogi who had done a long years of meditations and spiritual practices. This came upon him totally unexpected. And some of the characters in the Bible, in fact, usually that sort of experience comes totally unexpected.
Thinking like being born again, is that what you're...
Well, like St. Paul on the road to Damascus, he had an experience of light that blinded him, and that was certainly totally unexpected.
But not totally unrelated to what went before.
No, no. Good point. But he... had been a chief persecutor of the Christian sect, and then had that experience. No, not totally unrelated, no. No.
How would you relate that to the charismatic experience?
I don't know.
To use an overworn word.
I don't know what that is.
Experience with the Holy Spirit where a person...
Yeah, you could say it was that.
Suddenly sees things quite differently.
Well, in his book, which he wrote about, 1872, the book was written in the 1890s and was published in 1901, he has 50 instances of what he calls cosmic consciousness. He's a psychiatrist and scientist, so gives it a kind of a name without particular religious implications, you know, that would fit into Christianity or Judaism or whatever, Islam. So, and he has 50 instances of what he calls that, and among them are the experiences of Jesus, the River of Jordan, of Moses, the Buddha, various great literary figures like Dante, Alighieri, Walt Whitman, and then quite a few people who were people he knew and who told him about their experiences, who didn't want their names revealed, so they just gave initials. So there are quite a few initials in there. And I have ten of those in my, I chose 10 from in my book, and then in the latter part of my book, I chose 9 contemporary authors in these subjects who wrote about their own experience, and then I gave a lecture on this before the book was published, and one woman wrote me about her 2 experiences, and they were very powerful experiences, and I made that a 10th, and she's just listed by her initials in the book.
Could you give us some examples? You referred to all these experiences.
Yeah. Okay. Let me do that. All right. Let me give you an experience of a Lutheran from Jacob Boma, who was a shoemaker, and he was born in 1575 and died in 1624 in Germany, and he had very little education, maybe only elementary school education. But after his experiences, he wrote many books on spirituality. And let me give you, he had 2 experiences. One, in the year 1600, at the age of 25, sitting one day, his biographer says, in his room, his eyes fell upon a burnished pewter dish, which reflected the sunshine with such marvelous splendor that he fell into an inward ecstasy, and it seemed to him as if he could now look into the principles and deepest foundations of things. He believed that it was only a fancy, and in order to banish it from his mind, he went out upon the green. But there he remarked that he gazed into the very heart of things, the very herbs and grass and the actual nature harmonized with what he had inwardly seen. He said nothing of this to anyone, but praised and thanked God in silence. He continued in the honest practice of his craft, and was attentive to his domestic affairs, and was on terms of goodwill with all men. Then he had, 10 years later, at the age of 35, a further experience, even more awesome than that first one. Bauman says, The gate was opened to me that in one quarter of an hour I saw and knew more than if I had been many years together at a university, at which I exceedingly admired and thereupon turned my praise to God for it. For I saw and knew the being of all beings, the bis and the abyss, and the eternal generation of the Holy Trinity, the descent and the original of the world of all creatures through the divine wisdom. This is Bowman's words. I knew and saw in myself all the three worlds, namely the divine, angelical, and paradisical, the dark, the original nature of the fire, and then the external and visible world, being a procreation or external birth from both the internal and spiritual worlds. And I saw and knew the whole working essence in the evil and the good, and the original and the existence of each of them, and likewise how the fruit-bearing womb of eternity brought forth, so that I did not only greatly wonder at it, but did also exceedingly rejoice. And he went on in his craft of his shoemaking, but he wrote a number of books after that. I don't know if I have them listed here or not. Anyway, he maybe you know them, Jerry. He had a number of The Way to Christ, The Signature of All Things. Anyway, he, from his own inner inspiration, he wrote various books. That would be one example of what he's talking about. And there are others that take a lot of time to go into all of them. I chose Experiences of John Yates or St. John of the Cross. Anyway, that was an attempt to verbalize experience that's really unverbal. William James, who himself was not a mystic, he's claimed no mystical experience, but yet wrote this book, Varieties of Religious Experience, talked about four. I have other things to pass out, which I forgot about. I have, see if I have enough, box stages of consciousness, and then take one of each. And then William James, four criteria of mystical experience. Let me kind of jump over from the story of Bach, which I may go back to William James. William James, as you know, was one of the greatest American philosophers. Curiously enough, he had his degree was a medical degree. He went to Harvard Medical School. He was not a PhD in philosophy, nor in psychology, but he never practiced medicine, and he became one of the first great American psychologists, and then later philosophers. You know, look at the James' criteria of mystical experience. From what I read there, this was William James, the American contemporary of Richard Bach, much more well-known, by the way. James said the four criteria of mystical experience are, one, ineffability. The handiest of the marks by which I classify a state of mind as mystical is negative. The subject of it immediately says that it defies description, expression, I should say, that no adequate report of its contents can be given in words. It follows from this that its quality must be directly experienced. It cannot be imparted or transferred directly to others. That's, you will note on descriptions of these experiences that the writer is having a hard, has a hard time really expressing it. It's very inexpressible. Number two, noetic quality. Although so similar to states of feeling, mystical states seem to be those who experience, mystical states seem to those who experience them to be also states of knowledge. They are states of insight into the depths of truth, unplumbed by the discursive intellect. They are illuminations, revelations, full of significance and importance. And as a rule, they carry with them a curious sense of authority for after time. Three, James, transiency. Mystical states cannot be sustained for long, except in rare instances, half an hour, or at most an hour or two, seem to be the limit beyond which they fade into the light of common day. That was true of my experience I had at age 20, was 20 to perhaps 20 minutes to 30, which is a long time. Some of these are only seconds. Four, passivity. Although the oncoming of mystical states may be facilitated by preliminary voluntary operations, as by fixing the attention or going through certain bodily performances, something like yoga, or in other ways which manuals of mysticism prescribe, yet when the characteristic sort of consciousness once has set in, the mystic feels as if his own will were in abeyance and indeed sometimes grasped by a superior power. So, Buck, who had that experience, talks about quite a number of other, about 11 characteristics of a mystical or spiritual experience, not just four. Maybe I'll read those to you. Somewhere in here, I don't know where everything is yet. Here. Buck had 10 or 11 criteria of what he called cosmic consciousness. One is the subjective light. The person suddenly, without warning, has a sense of being immersed in flame or rose-colored cloud. That was really his own experience. I'll say more about that later. There isn't always an experience of light, but there could be an experience of unity. In fact, there was a later a woman writer on mysticism called Evelyn Underhill who wrote published a book in 1911 called Mysticism, which talked about the illuminative experience of light and then the unitive experience of unity. But back to Buck, the moral elevation. At the same time, he is, as it were, bathed in emotion of joy, assurance, triumph, salvation. B. C. The intellectual illumination, or three. There comes to the person an intellectual illumination quite impossible to describe. Like a flash, there is presented to his consciousness a clear conception, a vision in outline of the meaning and drift of the universe. Four, the sense of immortality. And this applied to what I experienced. The sense of immortality, this is not an intellectual conviction, such as comes with the solution of a problem, nor is it an experience such as learning something unknown before. It is far more simple and elementary and could better be compared to that certainty of distinct individuality possessed by each one which comes with and belongs to self-consciousness, a sense of immortality or experience, the loss of the fear of death. Some of these would apply to the near-death experiences that some books have been written on it. The loss of the sense of sin, or forgiveness of sin. Next, the suddenness or instantaneousness of the awakening. Next, the previous character of the man, intellectual, moral, and physical. The previous character of the man who enters the new life is important in each case. The age of illumination. Here he claims that one doesn't tend to experience such things until 35. He was 35, but there have been, in the second half of my book, contemporary cases, I talk about the 10 people, and one of them, Dr. Gene Houston, had that experience at age 6. So the ages can vary, but it's mostly, yes.
Go ahead, finish up.
Oh, okay. And then the added charm to the personality and so on. And finally, the transfiguration of the subject. There seems to the writer to be sufficient evidence that with cosmic consciousness, while it is actually present, a lasting, gradually passing away, a short time thereafter, change takes place in the appearance of the subject of illumination. Transfiguration, he calls it. So, those are...
What I was going to say, Robert, is that when you were talking about ages, a woman who is a member of my congregation shared with me an experience that she had.
Yeah.
Because we had a close relationship and she understood my openness to that.
Yeah.
But she was 90. And she was sure that if she shared that experience with her family, that they would
put her away.
Put her away.
Oh.
So her age was for her. And she was just very sure that. So she, it was a very private. She didn't want to share it beyond that. But it was. I was glad she could share it with me. But that was really her fear that her family would.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what does it mean to people outside of those who have been experienced, like if you speak of?
I don't understand the question.
Well, does it have any value for anyone except the person having the experience?
Yeah, it could be very great value because Bachfeld. Oh, and in the latter end of the epilogue of my book, I compare. Ideas and theory of Buck, Richard Maurice Buck, the psychiatrist, who was trying to stay within the naturalistic area, to the Jesuit priest, Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, who wrote The Phenomena of Man, and he has an almost identical theory of three levels coming to a kind of Christ consciousness. It's just a different language. It uses the language of the Christianity, and the descriptions of those are almost identical. So that's one point.
What did the experience?
The great cases of this experience. Tended to be founders of world religions, so they had very great influences upon the world, and some of the great literature was by people who came to this experience. It could be a very healing experience. Dante Alighieri, The Divine Comedy. He didn't really mean that literally, the journey through hell, purgatory, and paradise. It's symbolical. And John Bunyan, Pilgrim's Progress. William James, to add to this, talks in his book, I have no time to go into everything he talks about, the varieties of religious experience. He has a chapter on the healthy soul and the sick soul, and he talks about two great figures of literature who were sick souls. They were Leo Tolstoy and John Bunyan, who suffered severe depressions, really suicidal depressions, and terrible inward suffering. And he describes from their autobiographical writings their very gradual recovery through a gradual spiritual kind of awakening, not an instantaneous one, but in their cases was a very gradual kind of spiritual awakening, a kind of discovery of God, and then a healing of their tell you a little about
So are you saying then that the same experience can be had by kind of a spiritual evolution? Is that what you're saying?
James with the cases of Tolstoy and Bunyan. Bunyan was also a totally uneducated man, and he was one of the protesters against one of the member of one of the churches that were protesting against the Church of England. There were a lot at the time, and eventually he went to jail for his non-conformity, and he had already had a spiritual journey that he talks about in an autobiography called Grace Abounding to the Chief of Sinners, something like that, Grace Abounding to the Chief of Sinners, and it's his own personal story. It's kind of boring and hard to read, but based on that he wrote, kind of from inward vision, a great mythical book called Pilgrim's Progress. How many have read the Pilgrim's Progress? That's a wonderful book. He was only had about a third grade education, but that's one of the great books of all time. And it's about a mythical way about a man named Christian who goes from the city of woe and despair, city of woe, on a long journey, eventually to the celestial city. So it's a spiritual journey. And on steps to that, there's the Valley of the Humiliation, where he fights, battles the devil. There's the Valley of the Shadow of Death. There's various nice things like Palace Beautiful. Anyway, it's a symbolical story of his journey. And so when he made that into a sort of a mythical form, it became, still around the Pilgrim's Progress. And Tolstoy was a great Russian novelist. Maybe I will end up on Tolstoy and William James, a gradual case of spiritual rebirth. Like the cases of Buck are all the kind of instantaneous mystical experiences. This is, William James has two cases of gradual spiritual rebirth. Leo Tolstoy, the great Russian novelist, Leo Tolstoy, went through a prolonged and severe period of melancholy and depression, which he overcame through a gradual spiritual rebirth and reawakening. At the height of his literary fame, when he associated with some of the great literary figures of the world, he went into a period of profound depression, where he said he felt that something had broken within him, on which his life had rested, had always rested, that he had nothing left to hold on to, and that morally his life had stopped, and he had definitely suicidal thoughts. And he said, a man in good health, behold me, a man in good health, hiding the rope in order not to hang myself on the rafters of the room where every night I went to sleep alone. Behold me, no longer going shooting, lest I should yield to the too easy temptation of putting an end to myself with a gun. This was Leo Tolstoy. And the only thing that kept him going, he said, was his thirst for God. So this would be a case of I suppose psychiatrists say clinical depression, and prescribe Prozac or something like that. Okay. Jane states that when disillusionment had gone as far as it had with Tolstoy and Bunyan too, there's no restitutio ad integrum, or return to the earlier state of innocence. So with Tolstoy, he said, however it may be that man is reborn, Tolstoy pursued his unending questions of life and eventually came to insight after insight, and this is his beginning of recovery, and he came to the intuition that his conclusion that his own life was meaningless took only his small finite life into account, but meaning is not found in finites, not in this thing and that thing and another thing, but in the infinite whom men call God. Reason, this is Tolstoy, can never discover this, but faith can. Tolstoy observed this simple faith and joy in life in humble peasants whom he observed, but he had not much seen this in the upper class wealthy circles whom he had associated with. Something like blessed are the poor, or the poor in spirit. The literary grace. So Tolstoy wrote this, since mankind has existed, wherever life has been, there's also been the faith that gave the possibility of living. It is this force whereby we live. This conviction of faith was the beginning of Tolstoy's recovery from his years of despair. To believe in God, therein lay happiness again. And then he had a kind of experience. I remember one day in early spring, I was alone in the forest, lending ear to its mysterious noises. I listened, and again there rose in me glad aspirations toward life. Everything in me awoke and received a meaning. Everything in me awoke and received a meaning. That's kind of a spiritual experience. Why do I look further? A voice within me asked, he is there, he without whom one cannot live. To acknowledge God and to live are one and the same thing. God is what life is. Well then, live, seek God, and there will be no life without him. And then he said, after this, things cleared up in me, within me, and about me better than ever, and the light has never wholly died away. I was saved from suicide. So that this James' account of a gradual spiritual rebirth of Leo Tolstoy, and it's a somewhat similar thing with John Bunyan, so they had, let me give you a little of John Bunyan, in his own words, on his dark side, nay, thought I, now I grow worse and worse. I am farther from conversion than I ever was before. If now I should have burned at the stake, I could not believe that Christ had love for me. Alas, I could neither hear him, nor see him, nor feel him, nor savor any of his things, but my original and inward pollution, that was my plague and affliction. And then during his gradual recovery and his spiritual quest, he said, my peace would be in and out 20 times a day. Comfort now, trouble presently, peace now, and before I could though a furlong as full of guilt and fear as ever heart could hold. And then later, and now remained only the hinder part of the tempest, for the thunder was gone beyond me, only some drops would still remain. And at last, now did my chains fall off my legs. Indeed, I was loosed from my afflictions and irons. My temptations also fled away. Now I went home rejoicing for the grace and love of God. A spiritual rebirth and the healing of depression, suicidal depression. And from that he wrote the Grace Abounding to the Chief of Sinners, and then the great book, Pilgrim's Progress. And so that's some of the results of things like that. And now, in psychiatry, a spiritual treatment or something of emotional ills is not very popular. That's not scientific, you know. But there's one psychiatrist in, he's in California, Stanislav Grof, and he believes quite the contrary of Freud and behaviorists and others, or drug psychiatrists, that the spiritual or unitive or spiritual experience is the deepest kind of healing, and only that kind of things brings healing. And he's a distinguished psychiatrist with many, many publications, and was a teacher. And he was originally from Europe. He's still around. He's in his early 60s, I think. And he's written a number of books. He in psychiatry is affirming the spiritual, also M. Scott Peck in psychiatry, and in psychology, Jean Houston is developing what she calls sacred psychology, and she discovered quite a long ago what she calls four stages of consciousness, which she discovered with the LSD research, and really rediscovered the exact same thing that that Buck talks about. So so there you have Buck, who deals with rather what's called the mystical experience, which is kind of an instantaneous spiritual experience, and something on James with a gradual spiritual rebirth, and he also talks about yes.
The question: what's the practical impact of all this? Seems to me we Westerners have we're so rationalistic. We have to be scientific. We're left brain or is it right brain?
Yeah.
That we've cut ourselves off from this more intuitional or holistic or cosmic consciousness thing,
mm-hmm.
and that people, especially a lot of us Protestants, are so much this way that a lot of people now are finding this so devoid of wholeness that they find it in charismatic experiences or in some of the more feeling religious celebrations, mm-hmm. that get in touch with some of this.
Mm-hmm.
I think.
Experiential instead of intellectual.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or in addition to
our Western religion of Christianity is very has been very intellectual, but it wasn't so. I had some teachers who wrote on John Sanford.